True Crimers, welcome to Break the Case. I'm your host. I'm Jen Coffin Dafford. Thank you so much for being here on this afternoon at about 4 o'clock, at least Eastern time. I really appreciate you being here. We are breaking down something that has really confused a lot of people, I think, online regarding the Nancy Guthrie case. And so even though it's been talked about, and actually right after the plea deal, I talked extensively about it and did a whole show on it, because I'm getting so many DMs and concerns in my feed regarding Derek Colella, I really thought it was worth the revisit. And even looking at chat, I also see that some people are like, who is this? Who is this guy? So I thought it was worthwhile to come back on. And there's been a lot of speculation, I think, basically because, let me just put it this way. I think that there are some people that haven't dealt with plea agreements like this. They're not federal agents. They haven't had these federal type of plea agreements that they've had to deal with. And I think that caused some confusion and really raised the flag. And then, of course, everybody wants to run with it once the flag is raised, right? It's way more exciting to make a big deal out of essentially nothing when it means that you're going to have people tune in. Ooh, what happened? What's secretly going on? So I just wanted to quell all of that, explain what went on with Derek Colella, and just get some logical as well as fundamental factual information regarding Derek Colella. So who is Derek Colella? And again, we're going to be talking about the Nancy Guthrie case. Nancy Guthrie was kidnapped, violently kidnapped, judging by the blood on her stoop, judging by the fact that it certainly is believed by most people that she is no longer with us. And it's just sad and so very tragic. This all happened on February 1st in the wee morning hours. The last sort of connection with her pacemaker to her phone was at 2:28 in the morning. I know many of you have followed this case so closely, and we're going to continue with our analysis of the ransom notes. We've had two amazing individuals come on board. One, a current police officer at Ohio, who studied under, many would say the best of the best, studied under Peter Hyatt, and now is carrying the torch, continues to study. We had his analysis, which was amazing, Steve Pagano. And then we also had on Lena Sisko, who there was a certain just synergy between Lena and I. There was no doubt. I loved her analysis. She brought up a couple of points that I had never really considered fully. At the very end, I'm going to do a show strictly that kind of puts together everybody's analysis, because as Steve mentioned, and I've also told you, is that what happens in these kinds of cases is it's not one person deciding all of this. It's kind of a brain trust of agents and individual task force members that get together. And particularly when you're talking about statement analysis, you want to incorporate a lot of people. And I thought Lena pointed out a really good point, that the statement analysis being done in this case, for the most part, is really not being done in large part by people who have devoted their lives and their understanding to statement analysis. That's not to say that your regular agents and your also your, you know, police officers who have cases, not that their input means nothing, but just think of how few people have actually seen a real ransom note or an extortion note. Very few, unless you work those kinds of cases. I'm so fortunate that I have had those kinds of cases. I actually talked about one particular note that I had in my career when I was talking to Lena. And you learn from each of those, time behind the tiller. But there's people who teach it, like Lena, who study it and know about it. And we're going to have another statement analysis expert, that this is what he does really for a living on. And that will round out, I think, the top three statement analysis folks in the industry. And then at the end, I'll do a show that I, just where it kind of all came together for me, what each analyst said. And then also, you know, kind of the ultimate conclusion from all of them, because all of them really are on the same page in most regards, but there were a couple little nuggets that I really thought were particularly insightful. So that is Monday. We've got a lot of huge shows coming up. Tomorrow, I'm so blessed to be joined by Dale Lundberg. Again, Dallas Police Department, homicide detective, not a small police department, a big, huge police department, 10 years in homicide. Prior to that, worked kidnappings and robberies. He was featured multiple times on 48 Hours, the television show. He's just a great guy, so down to earth. And I'm just so lucky that working on a homicide investigation with him, that we kept up with each other and have always remained friends and sort of comrades. So he'll be joining us to talk about kind of what happens when your case is at the 6-month mark. What are you doing? He's just going to talk about it from the perspective of a homicide detective. Then we have Saturday. We have Friday coming up. We're going to be discussing again the Lindsay Clancy case, but I have a very interesting guest. She's a PhD, background in psychiatry, background in philosophy, background in psychology, one of the premier criminal psychologist folks that are in that very small and tight realm, a true academic. We've had her on before, Dr. Camilla Eppright. She's going to be joining. I think I'm going to have an absolute opposite take. I haven't talked to her, but that would be my guess. I always like to start in very fresh. And then Saturday, we're going to break down what went on this last week on the Tupac Shakur trial. That's going to be with Philip DeBay. He's so amazing. On Wednesday, a real treat for you. Next Wednesday, we're going to do the JonBenet Ramsey case. Lena Sisko is going to be coming back. She's not only going to talk about the Ramsey ransom note, but she's also going to talk about the Larry King live show. We have a lot to say about that. So anyway, usually I do this at the end. I'm doing it at the beginning. I'm not sure why. But anyway, now you know what we have coming up ahead. We've got a lot, really trying to put together a lot for you, especially having been gone that period of time, and get everybody back on track with some great shows set up for you covering our major cases. And our major case, of course, is the Nancy Guthrie case. So Derek Colella, who is this fellow? Because I literally have so many people that did not know who he was. Oh, Derek Colella. He's a California man, though he was indicted in Arizona. And the reason he was indicted in Arizona was because that was the venue that was determined, because he specifically committed a crime that went to and was tracked concerning the Nancy Guthrie case. So it was indicted here as opposed to where he was when he sent the messages. That's very important to understand. All of this happened in Arizona, not in California. All right. I want to talk about the initial charges, and I'm going to put up some receipts here. This obviously is really small, so I'm going to go to my phone to read, because I quite frankly have pretty much no chance of seeing this from far away. So Derek Colella, we're just going to read from the documents. I'm not going to ad lib, so each of you understand what in the world happened with this guy. Why was he charged? What was it about? So let me get down to that. Let me find this first page. Forgive me. I did not screenshot my first page where I can easily find it. Oh, no, I did. Well, I didn't. I'll have to read it from here. There's no chance I have to read that. I have the other two pages of the criminal complaint. I don't know why I did not write down. I can't believe I didn't save the first two pages in a format where I can actually read it. Let me see. I'm going to have to get up close and personal here. But essentially, this is a complaint. I first want to explain what a complaint is, okay? So when you have, when you're a federal agent, and I'm going to speak from a federal agent, first of all, this is a federal case. And secondarily, that's my background and experience, even though I was embedded in task forces and very specifically in a gang task force, as well as a counterterrorism task force. Even though that my experience, the breadth and the substance of my experience is from FBI special agent. So these documents are very familiar to me. This is a criminal complaint. There's three ways to charge. Number one, first of all, that is by criminal complaint. What does that mean? This is when something is so exigent, something happens so quickly, criminal action, that you don't have time to go to a grand jury, but instead you actually write out your criminal complaint. And in this way, you are able to charge somebody. So you as an agent are literally writing out your probable cause that somebody has committed a federal crime. Now, remember, this case was extremely exigent. You had a case where somebody had been kidnapped. You had these particular messages that went into her daughter, Nancy Guthrie's daughter's cell phone text messaging, as well as Nancy Guthrie's son-in-law, Tommaso Cioni. So because of that, this was extremely exigent. So you had an agent grab a hold of this case, write up his probable cause statement, and then go and see an assistant United States attorney post-haste and get this out. So that's what happened. All right, guys, I'm going to have to get up close and personal just on this first page. Okay. Complaints, statement of facts constituting the offense for violation. So that's what we do. The first thing, even when you're opening a case, I have to tell the FBI, the Bureau, in an electronic communication, you know, what in the world I am trying to charge. What do I see in a fact pattern that lends itself to being a violation of federal law? So that's why individuals, agents, it's so imperative that they understand the law. Because if you don't understand the law, how in the world are you going to know if somebody is violating it or not? All right. So you always start out, and I'm going to put in the counts. What violation did this person commit? And again, this is a criminal complaint charging Derek Colella with these particular violations. And you can see there, it was filed, I believe, on February 5th. Help me if I'm wrong there. That's what my recollection is. So on or about February 4th, 2026, defendant Derek Colella, and then they call him Colella. Oh, you guys are going to kill me. I'm going to have to really get up close here. I literally can't read it. So guys, my eyes are just too bad. But basically, he was charged with two counts of sending text messages to both Annie and to Tommaso Cioni in violation of these two particular laws. And you can see them there for those of you who have amazing eyes. But I want to go on with what I actually have here. And this is really the meat and substance. This is sort of the cover page, not sort of, this is the cover page that typically just has the counts that are alleged in the criminal complaint. So it goes on to say on page two, you see page one here, and let me get to page two. It goes on to say, underline, the disappearance of NG. NG, which is obviously Nancy Guthrie, and earlier on page one, we parenthetically, when we write, we will put short names or acronyms for people. A lot of times we use their last names. Sometimes we'll say Mr. So-and-so, and other times we will give their initials. So in this case, this special agent decided to use NG for Nancy Guthrie. NG was last seen inside her residence in the Catalina Foothills community outside Tucson, Arizona on January 31st, 2026. NG is an 84-year-old woman with mobility issues that likely preclude her from walking long distances unassisted. On the morning of February 1st, 2026, a friend of NG's contacted the victim's family and notified them that NG had not attended church that morning. Now, we know this has really been shortened because it wasn't church that she actually went to. It was a church group that was at a friend's house that she went to worship. After 9/11, she changed from going to church to going to with this group church. But this is how it's put together in this affidavit. Had not attended church that morning. Just didn't get into specificity. At approximately noon on February 1st, 2026, NG's family entered her residence and determined that she was missing and reported her disappearance to law enforcement. Law enforcement arrived shortly thereafter and determined that NG had left basic essentials inside her home, including her wallet, her car, her cell phone, her hearing aid, and medication. And by the way, we know now because of the dispatch information that she also left her cane. I had a whole show on that, discussing what this dispatch information revealed. But so the list was basically everything that she would normally leave with, right? Wallet, car, cell phone, hearing aid, and medication. And we know from the other, her cane. So this agent didn't list the cane, but we later came to know the cane was gone too. NG's blood was found on the outside of her residence near the porch. Now, the reason this is kind of interesting to me is they don't mention any blood inside the residence. And to keep in mind how brief they are being, NG, Miss Church, they don't list everything she left behind, right? So this could be because they don't want that information out. So I just wanted to make that clear that not saying that there was no blood inside does not mean there wasn't blood inside. We just quite frankly don't know. Okay. So, okay, near the porch. Okay. Paragraph two, and you can see it all right here on paragraph two. I'm in the first section. On February 2nd, 2026. So remember, and I've said this before, it was very confusing and a lot of people misrepresented that these notes came in late, that they didn't come for days. So that was all extremely incorrect. They came on the 2nd. On February 2nd, KOLD, a CBS affiliate in Tucson, received a ransom demand via their online tip portal. That's also been very misunderstood. And I think sometimes it is good to revisit some of these facts, even though we've gone over them many, many times. It's just a good refresher. It's been 6 months, everyone. Just think of all the cases we've covered. I don't know exactly what episode we're on. I think we're well past 160 episodes with a lot of detail, a lot of information. So I love that we're recapping this as we go through the criminal complaint that charged, again, our topic of discussion is Derek Colella. And this recaps what he was charged with and what he was initially, what they said he did. So first of all, the reason this first section, they have to lay, almost fell off my stool, they have to put down the background. Okay, so again, on February 2nd, 2026, KOLD, a CBS affiliate in Tucson, received a ransom demand via their online tip portal. So this wasn't an email. We've talked about this, right? It literally came through this tip portal, which I think someday when this case is solved, that is going to be important, because I still think, is it really possible? Is it possible that someone connected with doing this? And I believe it's a conspiracy. I've said that from the beginning. I don't think it's just Porch Guy. I know some people believe that. That's not me. I think there's multiple people involved. I pointed out the fact Porch Guy had a handy talkie. And I don't think the notes were written by him. And for all these reasons, I think that there's at least two involved, if not more. So this information says very specifically online tip portal. I just wonder if somebody involved in this worked at a media station, works in IT, and understands that tip portal tips are almost impossible to trace. Look, we're well over 6 months in. The FBI, subject matter experts, all the people that are helping Savannah Guthrie, you heard me right, because outside of law enforcement, I don't care what anybody is saying, I am very, very knowledgeable that she is being helped by other components, subject matter experts, to try to find her mom and to try to get to the bottom of who sent this into these tip portals and also the Bitcoin address. Nevertheless, via the tip portal, the demand listed Bitcoin wallet address to receive the ransom payment. I also want to point out here, for those who are still not convinced that the FBI believes and has always believed that this is a kidnap for ransom, that's what they believe. That's what they put down in writing. That's what they sent out. That's what this case is carried under, is a kidnapping case. And that is what they 100% believe. So for everybody's asking, I wish the FBI would speak. The FBI spoke. And the FBI specifically said, this is a kidnap for ransom case, and they put it in writing. I'd like to say that, you know, there's some magic. It's not magic. It's paying attention. And so the individuals and channels and various people online that are trying to make this into something it isn't, it is very simply a kidnap for ransom case. That's how it's carried within the FBI. I've explained how we have to do case opening electronic communications that spell out our predication for a case. And that's how this case is opened. Okay. Further. And they're even writing it. My point is, they are swearing to this. At the very end of this, I'm swearing to a judge on this. So when I do a criminal complaint, it's way different than if you're charged by indictment or information. Those are the two other ways we can charge federally. In this instance, I have to go before a judge. I run everything by the prosecutor, get everything typed up. Once the prosecutor says, yes, you dotted your I's, you crossed your T's, I believe there's probable cause here. Then I go knock on the door of the federal judge, magistrate judge, not a district court judge. There's two judges, two levels. Initially, when you first have a case, you start out with your magistrate judge. This is what magistrates handle, things like criminal complaints, issuing arrest or signing arrest warrants. And That is what this agent did. They went to a magistrate judge. And believe me, I've had to wake up magistrate's judges at 3 a.m, in the middle of the night. I've had to track them down at church. I've had to track them down at brunch. When you need this signed, they're not in their chambers. I mean, unless it's 9 to 5 and really more like 10 to 3. They're gone, these federal judges. They don't work extensive hours except when they're in trial. So having said that, this agent went and tracked down this judge and is swearing. So they are literally swearing to the fact that they received a ransom demand. The demand listed Bitcoin and an address to see if the ransom amount. That's what they're swearing to, that they believe this. All right, I'm still on the first set, but I'm on sentence 3, if you can't see like me, but I have it down here. So on February 4th, 2026, Nancy Guthrie's family published a video asking Nancy Guthrie's kidnapped to contact them about their mother. Okay, we've all seen that horrible video, right? There's been 7 outreaches. The first outreach, again, occurred on February 4th. It included Cameron. It included Annie. It included Savannah. Savannah and Annie both spoke in that. We've watched it here. I have it here, but we're not going to watch it today. We're going to stay focused on Kalela. But this is what he's referring to. Okay. Count 1 and 2, which I should have just read from here rather than trying to read what I posted, which was this minuscule writing, or teeny writing that I can't read, but we're going to get into it here under section 2. Counts 1 and 2, on or about February 4th, so you have the timing down, on the 2nd, or on the 1st, she was kidnapped. On the 2nd, the ransom notes went to the local stations, and they talk about KOLD here. And on the 4th, they talk about what Derek Kalela did. On or about February 4th, after the video was put out from the family, okay, I'm going to read exactly what it says. On or about February 4th, 2026, shortly after the video was published, Annie Cioni and Tommaso Cioni, the daughter and son-in-law of Nancy Guthrie, both separately received a text message from the following number, blah, 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 stating, quote, did you get the Bitcoin? We're waiting on our end for the transaction. Annie and Tommaso received these texts while in Arizona. So again, I talked about at the beginning, the reason that they were charged in Arizona is because that venue was set, because that was where they received the messages. There was a lot of confusion. Even Sheriff Nanos said in California, he was confused. He also said he got 10 years. He was confused about that too. I've played that clip, but I'm not here to get on about Sheriff Nanos. He just opens himself up a lot. Nevertheless, so these came in on the 4th. Okay. Now, couple of things I just want to reiterate that happened. Does everybody remember seeing ICAC at Tommaso and Annie's house? Remember ICAC? So ICAC, they specialize in doing data retrieval from digital devices. They're forensics experts that are sort of mobile and go out. And they usually do crime against children. Internet crimes against children, ICAC. So if everybody remembers that image, and I actually should have, I have that image. I should have put it up here. But big bag, ICAC, and it was like, oh, see? they're guilty. It was critical to them to get this information post haste because they were in the middle of this investigation, everyone. They were trying to figure out who sent the information, where it came from. I mean, you can imagine getting this information like this. So they were all on top of this. Okay. So I wanna point that out about ICAC, because everyone's like, well, why is ICAC there? Well, ICAC was there because ICAC are the premier at doing these mobile digital forensic extractions post haste. And in a case like this, this is what they wanted. So, all right. Let's see. Oh, I also thought it was interesting, and I hope you guys can read this. Again, I'm on paragraph one under section two. Quote, did you get the Bitcoin? We're waiting on our end for the transaction. And they put a sick there, right? Because they mean Bitcoin account, but, they spelled it wrong. We're waiting. So it was a mistake instead of we are waiting. But isn't it interesting on both of our statement analyzers, right? How they brought home the fact that people who are trying to mitigate their role often use we. It's very interesting because Derek Colella acted alone, and he was trying, as we've seen in other notes, and as personally for me, I've seen throughout my career, people try to mitigate, particularly when they are singularly acting, they want to make everybody think, oh, all these people are involved. And that's what Colella was doing here. That would be the statement analysis of that. And then he fell right in line with that. Okay, moving to paragraph two under section two. Law enforcement was able to determine through open source methods that the number 0552, that's the number that sent the text messages, was associated with a voice over internet protocol, a VoIP text and call application that allows users to attain another phone number for their mobile device separate from the number assigned to them by their wireless carrier. So let me go over that again. A VoIP. If you've ever had one, and I have had one before, because as a business owner, I really didn't, and I was doing self-defense a lot at that time and firearms training, I didn't want my number everywhere. And so I went to Google and I got a particular number assigned to me so that people could call and they could call that number. And that is how they could communicate with me rather than having my personal phone number. So this is used by people legitimately, like me and many others, but it's also used surreptitiously, like in this case. So this isn't, by the way, some sort, you don't have to be a mental giant or an IT specialist to understand that this could be an avenue to cover your tracks. So they right away, the Bureau, again, through the ICAC information they got, they figured out that this was through a VoIP text and call application. Okay. They further, this special agent further alleges, law enforcement submitted an emergency. I mentioned this before. This was emergent. This is one of these situations that you don't sit around because you don't know at this point if Derek Colella kidnapped Nancy Guthrie. You don't know. So this is very critical that they do this. And this really lets you inside what happens on this case and what happened and how we function. Law enforcement submitted an emergency disclosure list for the 0552. So in other words, what we do is we contact the provider, Google, whoever, that had this number issued, and in an emergent way, within a very short amount of time, we get who got the number. So you can layer up everything, but you know, these people, but at the end of the day, it's going to come back to somebody, typically, even if it's a fake somebody. And then you have to look at how did they get that fake. But I don't want to get too off of this. I just want to say they did emergency disclosure to figure out who had gotten that VOIP, the VOIP. All right. Based on the records provided for the 0552 number, again, that was the number that had contacted Annie and Tommaso, it was registered to the following email address. And then it has that redacted out, so we can't see the email address. But it goes on to say the records also indicated that the 0552 number had been accessed from the following IP address, which they're naming 103, which is probably the last three numbers of the IP. So now they have, law enforcement has an email address and they have an IP address that got the VOIP that was used to send these text messages to Annie and Tommaso on February 4th. So at approximately 6:02 p.m. on February 4th, 2026, I lost my track here a little bit. Okay. At approximately 6:02 p.m., February 4th, 2026, law enforcement submitted an emergency disclosure request to the internet provider now for the 103 IP address to determine that the 103 IP address was associated with Derek Colella's residence in California. So you see what happened, and we're on the very last sentence there. This is all the steps law enforcement had to take to just do one thing, and that was to determine who text messaged Annie and Tommaso. This is a lot of paperwork, I'm telling you. They have to get these emergency requests. They have to get them answered. And then once they got the email and the IP, they still don't know who it is. And then finally, that third layer let them know it was Tommaso, or I'm sorry, excuse me, that the person who text messaged Tommaso Cioni and Annie Cioni was in fact Derek Colella. Okay. And then the final page of the probable cause affidavit, criminal complaint, which is what we're talking about right now. After Miranda warnings, okay, sorry, let me make sure I have this right. Yes. After Miranda warnings, they're really skipping to the chase here. So basically, what happened was then now they have the name Derek Colella, now they have an address, and they immediately send agents there. So what you have in a situation like this is we call these AO leads. They're auxiliary office leads. So I'm the case agent here in Phoenix, and I immediately send an EC, electronic communication, and you can prioritize everything different ways. There's urgent, there's priority, there's a routine. In this case, I am prioritizing this urgent. It's got to go and it's got to get there, and there's action that has to be taken. So now you have the agents that are in California, you have that supervisor. What does he have to do? First of all, he has to open a case. He's sitting behind the desk, he gets this lead that comes through, he opens up a case, and then he has to assign it. And usually he's not even writing any of this, to be honest with you. He is reaching out to the person he's going to have take it, and he says, you need to write an ONA, open and assign. But some supervisors, good supervisors, will just take care of that. Either way, now he's got an agent, and now they have to actually go through and you know, put together a team and go talk to this guy. Remember, they don't know yet that this person couldn't literally be holding in California Nancy Guthrie. They don't know. So they are operating on the assumption that this is legitimate and that they could have a situation. So you can imagine everything they're having to get together. They have to do an arrest operations plan. They have to get a team together. In this situation, they're likely going to use SWAT, so they have to get that approval. It's a lot, everyone. So just if you're wondering why, you know, all of this took a bit of time, that's why. After Miranda warnings, Kalela admitted to sending the two text messages. So just so you know, when they went in to talk to him, and people have talked a lot about this, he admitted it. And this often happens. I mean, when you, this guy, Derek Kalela, let me show you a photo of this fool. This is not a, some sort of, some sort of mastermind. This is a dope smoking, methamphetamine addicted opportunist who saw, as he testified to and swore to, he saw on the news, like so many people did, the message from the Guthries when they were on TV begging for help. I remember that one. It's really sad. I have it in my library, but I think you guys remember it. Savannah spoke. Remember, this is the one where they say, essentially, she's a nice person. Talk to her and you'll see, right? They took BAU, took that. It was also used in the Silence of the Lambs because, again, the BAU is small and the BAU uses this language when they think it's effective to get through to somebody who is empathetic or who has empathy and who might feel sorry for the actions they've committed. So they used it. And remember, the BAU also helped in the Silence of the Lambs construct that script. Many of you know that I helped, for instance, with Furious, the new movie out, Hulu and Prime, FBI agent show, starring Emmy Rossum, who was Fiona in Shameless. Every day I would read that script, go through it. We'd have a 3 o'clock meeting and go through, does this make sense? Does this not make sense? Should we use other language? Should we use other things like this? The Bureau did the same with the script regarding Silence of the Lambs. That is why there was this nexus between what you saw in the Silence of the Lambs and then what you saw in real life, true ransom communication regarding that ransom note. So it's all very, very interesting that this is no mystery that the FBI believe these notes are real and they used the BAU to help the Guthries communicate. All right. So he admits to sending the text messages. He admitted to using the VOIP VoIP account from which two actual text messages came. Kalela stated that he pulled family information from a cyber website. This was, again, nothing. I know many of you know this. It's good to recap because I was contacted by so many people that I was like, oh gosh, I need to talk about Derek Kalela and get into the weeds with what he was charged with, what he pled guilty to, what happened. All right. So he gets, again, he admits to everything. He admits to the VoIP. And then I'm going to just add this last page that I'm reading from. He admits those text messages came from his VoIP. Kalela stated that he pulled family information from a cyber website. Again, Annie Cioni, because this refers to her as Annie Cioni. That's her name. Previously Guthrie. Annie Cioni and Tommaso Cioni they were not hard to find. Teachers, gemologists, you know, somebody meaning, I don't mean that she's trained in gemology, so I shouldn't say that, but somebody who sells gems, who sells jewelry, they want to be found. Honestly, any of you can find almost anybody. Are you going to get to Savannah Guthrie's personal cell phone? No way. Unless you know somebody, you're not getting to that because she has layers. She has, I guarantee that phone is probably in the name of NBC or the Today Show, something along that line, right? So people have asked that. Why didn't they reach out to Savannah? He couldn't get to Savannah. These two were easy to get to. He ran a band. He wants to be found. He wants to be able to get gigs. He wants, you know, students to be able to find him. All of that before all of this, unfortunately now, nothing's available. Who would have it be available? I mean, they've been demonized. They have been accused of murdering, essentially, their mother-in-law and their mother. I mean, I can't wait, and mark my words, for these lawsuits. And I tell you what, I'll say this too. If I am wrong on this, like I said, I've said it many times, if I am wrong and Annie and Tommaso are involved, I will fall on the sword. I will say the FBI has been misled. I've been misled. Everybody in this deal was misled. And I will mea culpa to a huge mistake in understanding this case. But I hope you all keep track of all the accounts, all the former law enforcement, all these people that are supposed to also know what they're talking about to one degree or another, and held them responsible if it doesn't end up being the Chiomis. All right, let me continue with this. It's almost done with this part. Talked all this time and I literally am still not to the plea agreement. All right. He also admitted, this guy that we're talking about today, Derek Colella, he also admitted that he had been following the Guthrie story. Now, isn't everybody at that time? I mean, I look back in February. This was one of the most covered stories I've ever seen. It rivaled Gabby Petito. It rivaled the Idaho 4. Nancy Guthrie has rivaled both of those cases in terms of coverage, worldwide coverage, coverage in every media, mainstream, social media, YouTube, everywhere. He, like millions and millions and millions of others, were following Nancy Guthrie. Were following her being gone. And after that plea came on the 4th, this guy saw a big opportunity. He saw an opportunity. An opportunity to look up their addresses and see if he could make an easy buck. Now, let me finish. I'm almost done. Again, according to the affidavit, sworn to by a federal agent, believed by a prosecutor, because they have to show proof of all these things. You don't just go in and get to say it. You need to show it. Colella stated he pulled family information from a cyber website and that he had been following along and watching TV. When he said that he sent text messages, he was trying to see if the family would respond. data received shows that approximately 3 minutes after the text messages, Colella called a family member of Nancy Guthrie, which lasted 9 seconds. The two text messages have not been linked to the February 2nd ransom demand. So in other words, remember the ransom demand that we've all been talking about, that we've been doing all of this evaluation on? I've had the top statement analysis folks in the industry to talk about them. Recall that law enforcement is saying, Judge, he's not related to those two ransom demands that we believe are real from the abductors. He was acting separately. And Colella admitted to everything. So that's what he was charged with. That's what happened. That's his criminal conduct. That's what was sworn to. And that's what he was then ultimately arrested for. Okay. Now, I want to bring up this. Derek Colella, this isn't his first rodeo. Like, he's a fraudster. He's a fraud, meaning he steals money, allegedly. And this is what people like this do. They take advantage of the system. They take advantage of grieving families. This is what they do. He was part of this huge, pretty big, I won't say huge, huge means hundreds to me, but pretty big takedown of, it wasn't just him, several others that were stealing. You can see he was a Department of Health Services intermediate clerk. And he wrangled the system out of $9,000. So just so you don't think that Derek Colella, this is his first rodeo at trying to steal. No. Not his first rodeo. He saw an opportunity. He saw what happened. And he thought, I'll roll the dice. Plus, he's a meth addict. So he's really not thinking too clearly. And I don't know his personality except for to show you what his actions show. And his action shows really cocky. I don't call people narcissists because that's a clinical diagnosis, but his actions sure were narcissistic, thinking he could get away with it, thinking he could do it. But that doesn't surprise me at all, especially being on meth and getting away with other crimes in the past. So he's a bad guy. Now, this is where it gets interesting. Couple of things. One, people have tried to connect him to Tommaso and to Tommaso's drummer. I hope you go back and look at my episodes. I did a whole episode on the drummer and a whole I've done probably 3 or 4 on Tommaso, his links to other people, so on and so forth. Deep dived both of them. There is absolutely no connection between this California guy, this Tucson teacher, and this teacher. Zero. So if you are watching somebody who tries to say that they are, ooh, they're connected because they both sing. Ooh, they're connected. No, they're not. It's made up. It is malarkey. As Cuomo, he says something like Fugazi. I'm not Italian. Well, way back. Not related. Not related. Not in a band together. Not related. not associated. He saw TV, just like all of us saw, and he saw the opportunity, and he went on and searched and did a search of the database and got their numbers and sent the text messages. Again, I want to give you the exact verbiage of the text message. According to the criminal complaint, not according to the internet. Quote, did you get the Bitcoin? We're waiting on our end for the transaction. That's a quote. It's, you know, I like facts. I like sworn statements. I like these a lot. So there's that. All right. I want to further talk about the plea agreement that some people, and I know it's, well, some people, it's truly is just about clicks and likes and come view and woo, look at what I got over here. I got something that looks bad. There's nothing bad about it. This is one of the many white collar criminals, never in the federal criminal justice system, who got a deal like everybody else that's white collar. There was nobody that was harmed. He didn't threaten violence, nothing like that. So it is usual and routine, unfortunately, I know you guys don't like this, but to plea someone like Derek Colella, to plea him out. So they plea him down to the harassment charges. Let me get the plea agreement and read this part to you. So the plea agreement was filed on July 2nd, 2026. And again, I did a show, I think, the next day about all this. But just to go over it, the defendant agreed to plead guilty to count one and two of the indictment. So just to be crystal clear, after the criminal complaint was filed, and this is normal, we do a criminal complaint in the federal system right here that an agent swears to. That's enough to get somebody arrested. After that, probable cause has to be established either by a grand jury or by a probable cause hearing. So sometimes we have probable cause hearings, and probable cause hearings, essentially, we've seen a lot of them lately. We saw it with Robinson done in Utah. That was a really long one. That's the one that stands out to me because I couldn't believe how long it was. But essentially, a federal hearing like that lasts just a couple of days. They are not allowed to be mini trials. And that's what the defense wants. The defense wants a mini trial because they want to get as much information as they can. They want to put up as many witnesses as they can, because then they can try to get them to say something just a little bit different in trial and say, see, you know, look at what you said here. It was a little off. And the agent or whoever will go, oh my gosh. But anyway, that's certainly what defense wants. In this case, like in most cases, the huge amount of cases, we don't do probable cause hearings. What we do is we present the facts before the grand jury, and that's what they did. And again, this is a slam dunk, what I call a whale in a bucket case. It's a whale in a bucket because I've got the VoIP. I've got all the records showing that he had the VoIP, that he got it, that it came from his IP address, that the IP address was specifically to his address. And then I have a confession. So this is a slam dunk, whale in a bucket type of case. prosecutors hate the minnows in a bucket. That doesn't mean they shouldn't prosecute those two. Anyway, I digress. This is a whale in a bucket case. So easily they go before the grand jury, they get the indictment. Okay. So they go and they get the indictment, and the defendant agreed to plead guilty to count one and count two of the indictment, which charged the defendant with a violation of 47 USC 223, harassment using a telecommunication device, which was a class E felony. So he's got a felony on his record. So this is what he pleads to. Okay. He pleads to it. And again, he pleads to the fact that he used, and this is the important thing, really. How does the Bureau take these cases? It's because the use of essentially the wires, interstate commerce, to commit a crime. And that's why I'm telling you that ultimately, at the end of the day, although it's not going to happen because Kash Patel has made it very clear that the locals, he believes, have screwed this case up so much, he's distancing himself and he wants to use it as his excuse not to take the case. But I'm telling you, at any point, the Bureau could take this case if Nancy Guthrie was taken across state lines, across the border, or if they prove that those ransom, the first two ransom notes, are real. That is absolutely the nexus under 18 USC 1201. Please look it up, because there's an interstate commerce, they call it, connection by the fact that the wire was used when that was sent out to that tip line. That made it potentially a federal nexus and jurisdiction. Okay. So, and that's what they say here. Interstate, okay, exactly how we word it, though, it's so funny. The elements of which the defendant is pleaded guilty are that the defendant in interstate or foreign commerce made a telephone call or utilized a telecommunication device, whether or not conversation or communication, ensued without disclosing the defendant's identity with the internet, with the intent to abuse, threaten, or harass any person. So that's the federal nexus here. That's the federal nexus, okay? All right. So then, essentially what happens is they go over everything that I just read in the criminal complaint and that he made an admission, et cetera, et cetera. And the assistant United States attorney approves the plea, and it's signed, and he pleads. And the plea deal, which I found disgusting and distasteful and very wrong, did not involve jail time. It's only punishable by 2 years per count. This is not a big deal. Remember, the difference between a federal felony and a federal misdemeanor is if you can go to jail for a year or more, if that statutorily is applicable, then it's a felony. If it's less than a year, that's a misdemeanor. That's how we determine that. This is a felony. He's pled to a felony. So, you know, he can't vote. He can't carry a firearm, blah, blah, blah. But he has till September, I believe September 10th. Chat, let me know if I'm wrong, but I believe September 10th is when he's going to be sentenced. And he was ordered to drug rehab. He has all these things, right, that he could screw up before then. So in any event, some people made a real big deal out of a literal boilerplate clause, because the word "any additional agreements with Colella" would be separately filed. This is boilerplate, everyone. This is standard in these agreements, specifically in Arizona. He got a deal because he didn't do a crime that was punishable by very much. The judge recognized he's a meth addict. The judge recognized he wasn't a career criminal, even though he had that deal in California, the small state deal for $9,000. And gave him a break. Sadly, we see it all the time in white collar cases. Again, he didn't threaten violence. So when you look at the whole thing, what does the Bureau, what does the U.S. Attorney's Office get out of it? Well, it saves them going to trial. This trial would have at least been a week long. You have jury selection. You have to do opening statements, closing statements. You have to present the evidence. You're going to have to put up all these witnesses, right? You're going to have somebody on Google. You're going to have somebody from ICAC. You're going to have to, all these people, come on. It's going to be at least a week trial. At least. I know it seems like a slam dunker. They just take a long time. Look at how long it's taken for me just to explain all of this. So in any event, the prosecution doesn't have to worry about that. And for him, he doesn't have to risk going to prison for 2 years per count. So if he doesn't take this deal, to me, it was such a slam dunk. I think a jury would have found him guilty and he would have been looking at 4 years. But then there's all sentencing guidelines, complicated. They go into your history. What criminal history do you and don't you have? Do you have any history of violence? Are you drug dependent? Were you in your right mind? All these complications, right? So you never know what he would have gotten. My guess, he would have gotten no more than 2 years. So they said, all right, we're going to plead him out. He's got 5 months. If he doesn't screw up, he's going to get 5 years probation for both counts. I don't like it. I think it's terrible. I think it sends a huge message to all the other people. And as I said, there's been a lot more messages that have gone out like this to people that are peripherally involved in this case that I have firsthand knowledge of, that have gone out to people covering this case. And, you know, it just sends a really bad message to them. Meaning, no big deal if you do it. You're going to get probation. So I hate that. I hate that piece of it. But nevertheless, at least he was prosecuted. At least he has a felony. And by the way, he can't screw up for 5 months or else he's going to get the full weight of the sentence, or 5 years. So he's got to keep his nose clean. He can't do any more of these, you know, frauds. He's got to stay off meth. He's got to keep himself in line for 5 years. So the judge, in a sense, to me, is giving him just enough rope to hang himself, probably. Because I doubt a guy like this lives at home with mama, who takes all these opportunities. He might change his stripes. Look, second chances should be awarded to everybody. I'm a huge second chance person. But if I were a betting human, I would bet within 5 years, this guy messes up. We'll see. Maybe he won't. I hope he proves me wrong. I hope he gets his crap together and doesn't try to extort family member of somebody who has likely lost their mom. So it seems like, if it seems like that I don't have a lot of empathy for him or I'm too harsh on him, look at what he did to the family, to Annie and Tommaso. Look at what he put them through. Savannah, Cameron, them thinking that maybe they had the right person. It's really, really sad. But nevertheless, that's why he got it. There's no secret deal. There's nothing he knows. He's not going to drop a dime on Tommaso Cioni. Nothing is going to happen. So all I say is this. Everybody, for those who are telling you that something like that is going to happen, there's some secret deal that they haven't done their homework and looked. This is boilerplate language in all of these plea agreements. Because if not, then you have those who are really cooperating. They're turning evidence against somebody in the mafia or whatever it is. And all of a sudden there's a sealed and can't be seen. And they're like, ah, see, that's why we do it this way. So nevertheless, that is the rundown on Derek, Derek Colella. I want to add one quick thing here. When you look at this case, and everybody, of course, wants to say and villainize, and I've done a lot of episodes on this, Tommaso Cioni. I think in large part because of initial information, confirmation bias. I've had so many experts on here that have said, no way is the family involved. The law enforcement has said no way the family is involved. No one wants to believe it. But it happened in the Idaho 4 case too. I was out on an island all by myself. It's not Jack. It's not Jack. It's not Dylan. It's not Bethany. It's not the parents. There were people. There's literally a retired FBI agent that on air said it was Kaylee's dad might be involved. Just crap like that. So just take note as to who is saying that this guy is related and has some big information. You know, big information. He doesn't have squat except a meth problem and a propensity to try to take advantage of the victim families in this case. That's what Derek Cioni is about. Nothing else. I wanted to add really quick. I'm just going with common sense here. If Colella was Porch Guy, somehow related in some way that doesn't exist, by the way, I've looked for it. It's not there. Everything goes back to streamers and social media characters linking them with zero proof. It's horrible. There's no affiliation with them. Zero. And Colella, he even said, I didn't know these people. I saw it on TV. But everybody would rather make it all up. And that, by the way, is a fact and proof. When you have witness statements such as Colella's, that's called proof. All right. So in any way, if Tommaso is involved in this, and if Annie is involved in this, and if Savannah were involved with this, believe me, I still see it out there about Savannah too. Riddle me this. Why was Porch Guy at 2:12 a.m. seen on this camera? Why wouldn't Annie and Tommaso? Why wouldn't Annie and Tommaso why wouldn't they tell their accomplice, whatever you do, cameras are up here, might want to avoid them? Why does Porch Guy need to come on 2 days, on the 11th and on the 1st? What does he need recon? If he had all this inside information? Most importantly, why did Nancy Guthrie likely die? Because he didn't understand very well how sick she was. Because no family was involved. That's just one reason. There's so many others. But I wanted to hone in on this. All right, everyone. You guys have been great. I kept you for way too long. Thank you so, so very much. I can't wait to read the comments. I'm going to go back through them now. And I just want to say I hope you have an incredible night. Please join us tomorrow, 10 a.m. We are back on our 10 a.m. morning report. It will almost always be 10 a.m. I had a court situation this morning, but other than that, we're pretty much going to be on the 10 a.m. Time frame, 10 a.m. or 4 o'clock. And we have a huge show tomorrow because we have Dale Lundberg, who's going to join us as a seasoned veteran homicide detective, star, if you will, featured on 48 Hours multiple times. He's the man, in my opinion. And he's going to talk to us. He's going to talk to us. What do you do as a homicide detective assigned to a case like this, a huge case, and you're 6 months in and you don't have a pointer? What are you going to do? So anyway, everyone, hope to see you tomorrow at 10 a.m. You can hear what Dale Lundberg has to say. I can't wait. I just always love listening to him. He always talks so slow and methodical. No nonsense. He reminds me a lot of Cheryl McCollum. Love having her on too. Mac McCollum, I need to have her back on too. But nevertheless, until next time, everyone, tomorrow morning, may justice be served for Nancy Guthrie and for her family and for the families of all the missing.